This is Christian Hunter with a program we call A Time for Prayer. So grateful that you've joined with us. So grateful that you're coming with us hand in hand into the presence of the Lord. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us on the line from back in the Washington, D.C. area, over there in Virginia, Dr. Joe Douglas. And Joe worked in Washington, D.C. for 30 years. He's well-known, well-versed there. He's retired now, but he's written a number of books, Red Cocaine, The Exposure of the Cause Behind the Drug Wars, and, of course, then we've written a book called Betrayed, which is a story of the tragedy of the men, the soldiers who were abandoned in the wars we fought during this last century. But this evening we were going to talk about the Soviet use of drugs, what the Soviets learned experimenting on American soldiers following the Vietnam War, following Korea, because Dr. Douglas had an opportunity to spend a great deal of time with General Asenia, who had defected, I believe, from Czechoslovakia, was the highest ranking officer in that area to defect to the United States, and he knew what had been done to the boys we abandoned. So, well, that is the background. Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you give us the sort of the background of Major General Asenia, and then let's talk about what you've really learned about how effective drugs can be in controlling people, and certainly this knowledge is known to our leaders as well as to the communists.
I'd be glad to, Dr. Stan. General Asenia defected to the United States in early 1968. What is particularly interesting, he defected running for his life, is what it amounted to. General Asenia is particularly unusual because of the high positions he held in Czechoslovakia. He is the only person to defect to the West, as a matter of fact, who was part of the decision-making hierarchy. And while we could name positions for about 15 minutes, to give you an example of where he stood, he was chief of staff to the Minister of Defense at the ministry. He ran the Secretariat of the Defense Council, and the Defense Council was the highest decision-making body in the communist system in matters of intelligence, counterintelligence, defense, foreign policy, and the economy. So just thinking of those two positions alone, one can recognize that he really was in the catbird seat. He was able to see what was going on in all areas of the defense and foreign policy and the economy. And as such, was an invaluable source. But what made him especially valuable was he had a prodigious memory. Now, I can recall two things to describe his memory. We could be describing a meeting that took place, let's say, 25 or 30 years ago, and he could identify, just as we were sitting chatting, the key people who were at the meeting and the key statements that were made, what people said, and what was discussed at the meeting. He had a fabulous memory. I have often gone back to check my notes to see what we had discussed 10 years earlier, say, in a particular subject, and when I did, I was very surprised to find my notes almost identical to what I had made following a discussion of the subject 10 years later. So he had a fantastic memory, and when he defected, his main interest was really in helping the United States, his new country, and in undoing the main threat that we faced, which he knew so well, which was the Soviet Union. So he was extremely unusual as a defector, particularly also because he recognized the problem in defectors where people will tend to try and elevate their importance by making statements about things that they really didn't have any first-hand knowledge on. He understood that very well, and of course, from his positions that he held, he really didn't have to elevate his importance any. So he had very early on, right at the beginning, had made the decision that he would not speculate, and he would not, unless directly asked, and even then he was hesitant, and he would never falter to say the truth, even though it was politically incorrect or it was something they didn't want to hear.
In other words, something the Americans didn't want to hear.
Yes, and this was true quite often because the knowledge that he had of the system was often diametrically opposed to how the our own intelligence services thought the Soviet Union and communism actually operated, and they did not want to hear what he had to say. This is perhaps best reflected in the simple fact that when he was debriefed strenuously for a year, and then suddenly it was terminated, it was later picked up sort of informally for about 4 years when he was back working for the CIA. But in all those times, thinking about 6 years total, he was never really debriefed on any item of strategic importance. When I began talking with him in the late 1970s, and we would identify different subjects and we'd chat on them, and then I would ask what he'd been asked about relative to that subject by the people in the intelligence community, and his answer was generally, they never asked me anything about it. And the more I heard that, the more I got curious, so I went through with him and said, well, let's go through and identify the things you were debriefed on. And there were tactical items of unbelievable triviality, such as they took a whole week one time having him draw out the various Czech military insignia, which was just a way of wasting time because, as he told them to begin with, why bother? I mean, your people in the embassy can walk across the street to the Czech library and take all the Xerox copies or photograph all the books they want that have the Czech insignia and get something much better than he could draw on a piece of paper. I then went back also to obtain the classified intelligence reports on his debriefings, and went through them, and lo and behold, what they were reports on precisely what he said he had been debriefed on. And it's this type of thing that bothers you, because later on I found out that they never debriefed him on anything of importance. One of the best examples is he told his debriefers that when he defected that he believed that the most important information he brought with him was the details on the long-range strategic plan for the next 10 to 15 years and beyond.
Well, what was that long-range strategic plan?
That addressed all aspects of their strategy to destroy the United States, to infiltrate it, destroy it, the institutions, The strategy, the tactics, the whole works.
Well, now, was it going to destroy a religious foundation or a political foundation or our ideology or our economic infrastructure? How were they going to attack us?
All of the above. It was comprehensive, you know, from A to Z, soup to nuts, the whole thing. And it was laid out. You know, I spent about a couple of months talking with him about this plan and ended up writing it, my notes down into about 40 pages or so. And you know what happened when he told the people that were debriefing him about this and said it was most important information? He also added the caveat. He said that he would not discuss it with them until the decision to grant him political immunity had been made, diplomatic immunity, and which is a natural thing to do, a wise thing to do. Well, after that decision was made, nobody ever asked him about the plan. And the only person, to my knowledge, that ever did and talked to him extensively about it was myself.
Well, now, why did he want diplomatic immunity? Why was that important?
Well, because that was the only way to guarantee that he could stay in the United States.
I see. Okay.
So a secure haven.
All right. So he certainly didn't want to reveal all this and then have himself sent back to Czechoslovakia. So that's a very legitimate thing.
Yes.
But, of course, this master plan that really been carried out since then, certainly they're doing everything they can to destroy our economy now by facilitating shipping our jobs overseas. Did he get at all into this whole process of globalization, or was he aware of what we're doing today?
We did not discuss the New World Order or globalization. Now, when we talked about this, this was back about 1978 time frame, and a lot of what is going on today was not evident to many of us that hadn't thought about it back then, myself included.
About 25 years ago then.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was not something that was on the top of my mind to ask him, nor did I ask him about it. And that's, of course, the case with many things. It was only after there was something that I thought of and brought up that we would get into a discussion on that.
Well, you know, 25
years talking, you could never stop, though, because you just went from one subject to another.
Well, 25 years ago, what's going on today would have been unimaginable, that our leaders would be actively encouraging our corporations to go overseas, encouraging our jobs to be sent overseas. But so what were the things then that he discussed, you know, at that time with you specifically?
Well, you mentioned the question of religions. And you know, undermining religion was a key Soviet objective, going right back almost to the week after they were founded. They recognized that they were in competition, really, with religions, because communism itself was viewed as their religion, and they had to destroy this faith, particularly the Christian faith, and other that people had in the various Christian religions. So. They developed an entire strategy focused on this problem of religions, which was sort of a higher authority, a culture, a way of living, all of which contrasted with communism, therefore had to be destroyed or turned. And their approach to doing that, I might mention that the most important one was the Catholic Church, and the second most important one was the Jewish faith. Third was Islam, and then fourth was the various Protestant religions, particularly those in the United States, and then fifth you get into some of the Eastern religions, and then you get into the evangelical religions, and particularly in the United States, that they considered so important. And the approach in getting into these religions had a number of different dimensions. Like, one thing they would do was recruit the leaders in the different religions to their cause. And they were assisted in this by not only by trying to convince people that they should become loyal to the communist cause rather than the particular religion, but also put pressure on them as a result of blackmail. In other words, threatening to ruin them with blackmail they had on their behavior or their financial problems or their sexual proclivities, which would pretty much ruin the person, and use that as leverage to blackmail the person into coming on and supporting their cause. Another way was those people, to get rid of people, let's say, who were had strong religious beliefs that were anti-communist and to just get rid of them. And this was often done by giving them particular drugs that would cause them to either go insane or commit suicide.
And this was done in America?
We did not discuss this particularly in America. The key thing that was done in the Western Hemisphere, this was done heavily, I should say, in Eastern Europe and then in Western Europe. Within the United States and the Americas, the main approach was to infiltrate the seminaries, the teaching centers, the colleges where people took their religious education prior to becoming priests, ministers, rabbis, what have you. Their approach was to recruit people who were non-communists to attend seminaries and become, if you will, agents in support of the Soviet system. And they would go through the seminaries, and then after they go through the seminaries, of course, they have this education, they would go different places. Some would work up in the hierarchy of the church, others into the seminaries themselves.
So then they infiltrated the seminaries, and they used their agents within the seminary to undermine the practice of religion, the religious beliefs then of the new people coming in to study?
Yes, absolutely. And as an example of this, we were talking about the seminaries in Latin America, dominantly Catholic, and we were in this conversation because it was related in certain ways to drug trafficking that I was talking with him about very extensively in the 80s. And what he explained was that in the 1950s, when he was following it fairly closely, it was not unusual for 50% of the students entering a seminary to be communist agents. Most of these were witting agents, but some of them were unwitting agents, people who had been selected because of their worldly view, which matched the Soviet interests in forcing the religion into material concerns as opposed to spiritual concerns. So they basically ended up with these two types of people in the seminaries. Then they also recruited the priests, and of course as the people came out of seminaries, they operated them not only into the seminaries where they would then be teaching the next wave of students, but also into the hierarchy of the church. And as an example there, by 1960, there were three people from Czech intelligence who were up as priests inside the Vatican. And there was a roughly equivalent number also from Bulgaria and Poland. So you can see that they had a fair number of people right within the Vatican, and they did extend this, use this influence to begin to change the Vatican and the Catholic policies, which really took place dominantly in the early 60s as part of Vatican II. Another part of their strategy with respect to the Catholic Church was to infiltrate one of the main orders, the Jesuits, and use the Jesuits, this infiltration, to destroy the church from within. As an example of this process, most people have the belief that, or the understanding, that liberation theology, which swept into Latin America in the late 1960s following Vatican II, was a product of Latin American theology. And that is not what happened at all. Liberation theology was developed in Moscow in 1960-61, and then it was set aside to be surfaced in Latin America as Latin American theology following Vatican II, which created the conditions, the environment, for liberation theology to be accepted and to spread like wildfire as it did. So you can see that this is an all-pronged effort to really recruit various religions. There are other examples that you can see. You can see the seminaries in many of the religions being taken over by liberal forces in several of the Protestant religions. One of the very good friends of mine had said he had a curious experience because in the Episcopal Church that was becoming very liberal, and the hierarchy was very concerned about this. So about the late 70s or very early 80s, they appointed a very conservative minister to become bishop and to weed out the liberal strains that were developing. And my friend who knew him said he was very surprised because he was a good conservative minister, and he went over to the Soviet Union, he remembered, for a two-week visit. And when he came back, he started writing encyclicals on unilateral disarmament. And my friend could never understand it until he heard me talking about some of the mind control drugs that they were using at that time, and then everything fell in place in his mind.
And, of course, these are really very well-planned programs. America's been under attack for a long period of time. Anybody who believes that communism is dead has never stopped and thought, well, if communism's dead, why are there 1.25 billion people living under communism in China and the people who live under communism in North Korea and communism in Cuba and communism in Vietnam? Is communism really dead, or is somebody misleading the American people? We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're really talking about, well, we sort of got off onto the communist effort to destroy America from within, but I think this is a subject well worthwhile developing, and then if we can get on to drugs, perhaps, Dr. Douglas, if we don't get all the way through the subject of drugs tonight, can we do it another time?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, well, let's go on. What were some of the other things, then, besides infiltration of the church, infiltration of the seminaries, and an effort to destroy Christianity in every form, and Judaism, for that matter, because the people who have belief in something will not accept the hollow promises of communism.
Yes, and you know, the origins of that go back to the coup that actually brought about the formation of the Soviet Union back in 1917 in November. Following that coup, it's often referred to as revolution, but more of a coup, there were similar efforts underway in Berlin and I think one or two other German cities, and particularly in Hungary. And these resulted in temporary communist governments. But those governments didn't hold, and they were the new governments were really kicked out, and the people just rose up against the communist techniques and tactics that were being imposed from the people who had taken over following the revolution in Russia.
I remember there's Bela Kun, who was in, I think, Hungary at the time, and of course that was a terribly brutal regime, but it was quickly overthrown.
That's right. Now you had two people who sort of looked at what was happening independently. You had, over in Hungary, you had Georgi Lukacs, and then over in Italy, you had Antonio Gramsci. And both of these men were regarded as excellent communist theoreticians, the greatest ones following Lenin. And they had looked at this revolutionary process with an eye toward examining why the revolutions failed in Hungary and Germany. They concluded that it was really the Western culture that had formed a defense, and particularly the dominantly Christian beliefs that the majority of the people held in those countries, and that these beliefs were a very strong defense against the communist revolution and the communist ideology, of course. Therefore, they concluded that what we need to do is not to try and attack this culture head on, because it was the culture, and it's kind of hard to attack culture head on, but rather to infiltrate the culture and the institutions and gradually undermine this culture, particularly the belief, the Christian beliefs, to undermine them, to attack them, to criticize them, and eventually to destroy them to the extent that they would no longer provide this defense against the world revolutionary movement, the communist revolutionary movement. And so that was the the principal philosophy behind this infiltration that was very strong in the 20s and 30s to get inside and, if you will, begin this long march, what's referred to as a long march through the institutions, to undermine them and turn them from what they were intended to be covertly to institutions.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, and he is talking about how after the Russian Revolution was established, then there were other revolutions in Germany and in Hungary, but they failed. And so there was a man named Gramsci who was in Italy at the time, and he said, look, the reason that the revolutions failed in Germany and they failed in Hungary is because of the strong values that the people hold. And you're not going to be able to destroy these beliefs in freedom based upon Christianity by a head-on attack. You're going to have to infiltrate the society and destroy the very fundamental beliefs of the people. And so it was this idea of infiltrating the culture and destroying the culture laid out by Gramsci, which is one of the major techniques, one of the major strategies that has been followed not only in Europe but here in the United States, infiltrating our seminaries, infiltrated our education, destroying the belief in our founding fathers, not teaching it in our schools, just getting religion out of the schools, destroying our belief in God. And, of course, you tackle the next generation. You don't go after old folks like Dr. Douglas and I. You want the hearts and minds and souls of the children. That's why you take over education and you remove God and prayer from schools. Would that be a fairly good approach or explanation of what happened here?
Oh, absolutely, Dr. Stan. You hit the nail right on the head. You know, probably the first time I read something where people were really pointing out Gramsci and his strategy, and it's an excellent book to refer people to, is The Keys of This Blood, which was written by Malachi Martin back about in the 1970s, as I recall,
right,
early 1980s. And it's an excellent book, and in that book is a whole chapter, the first one that I've ever seen, that really laid out the effects of Antonio Gramsci and his strategy. And it was adopted. It was not really strongly pushed by Stalin, because Stalin did not want anybody's ideas interfering with his own. But when Khrushchev took over in 1954-55, as he gathered his power in, he recognized how badly the revolutionary movement had been set back, had been stymied by Stalin's policies. So he basically opened the door and let a fresh wind blow through this old mausoleum of ideas. He welcomed new thoughts in all aspects that just turned the place upside down. One of the first things he did was to send copies of Gramsci's books to all the satellite countries with instructions for them to read through it. And of course, this was his prison notebooks and his writings. Whether he did the same with Lukacs' material or not, I don't know, because I wasn't aware of Lukacs at the time that I was talking with Jan Sena, so I never really asked him about the Hungarian aspect. But what Lukacs wrote about is almost identical to Gramsci in this area, and of course Lukacs went a step further at the time. Gramsci was unable to because he was imprisoned back in the late 1920s, as I recall, and Lukacs went on with a number of people to form an entire school devoted to the destruction of Western culture from within, and this was known as the Frankfurt School. It got its start in about 1922, and then on the eve of World War II, it relocated first to Switzerland temporarily, and then to Columbia University with the help of our old friend John Dewey. Of course, this is where you then had the center of this massive effort to undermine U.S. education, which you brought up, and undermine it in such a way as basically to put the emphasis in our school system on teachers as change agents, political change, rather than on educating the students. So this is where you had the beginning of the real effort to change the thought processes in the schools to dominate the social sciences, and it was a combination of really work by the Frankfurt School in conjunction with the people at Columbia.
Well, it's amazing, amazing story, and the tragedy is that this is never talked about, not very much within conservative circles, within Christian circles, yet there's a planned program to undermine the very fabric of our society. Belief in God, belief in family, belief in country. They're incredibly successful, and it's about time the American people begin to recognize what's happening. You're not going to get this through your textbooks. You're only going to get it from people like Dr. Joe Douglas, who's had an opportunity to study this for 25 years, to interview this amazing communist defector who laid the whole story out. RCI didn't want to hear about it, maybe they already knew. They didn't want anybody to know they knew. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas. And Joe, just pick up the story from there.
I think the thing that we need to make sure that people don't jump to any conclusions here, Dr. Stan, is what we have is not just one force. You can't blame everything on the communists, per se. We have a communist movement that's coming in through this Frankfurt School, or I should say more appropriately, the Comintern. You also have a number of communist Russian KGB and GRU, that's their two intelligence services, their covert operations directed against the United States. You also have people such as the School of Education at Columbia that was very influential in changing of the U.S. educational system and gaining control of it. Although their views were very similar, I don't think we would want to call them communists per se. They were sort of unwitting dupes or fellow travelers.
Well, weren't they more or less Marxists?
They were Marxists, yes. I think most of them were, but not in the same sense that the Frankfurt School was.
Right.
And they were agents. And then you have the financing of efforts to gain control of our foreign and domestic policy through the university system. And this was run by the major tax-exempt foundations, particularly the Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Foundations, and then later on the Ford Foundations, and Guggenheim, Marshall Fields, and a whole bunch of them. And that whole movement began back with the Rockefeller General Education Board back as early as 1905.
Could I just mention for our listeners, if anybody would like to really understand the influence of the Great Tax Exempt Foundations, there's a book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which we've kept in print for the last decade. And if you want to know more about that book, a book that changed my life 20 years ago, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. That book, Crystallization, or the summation of the Reese Committee hearings. The Reese Committee actually was commissioned by the 83rd Congress to find out why the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie Foundations were financing communist activities. Didn't make any sense. Until, of course, you read the report. Pick the story up there.
Well, you bring in the Reese Commission, and the one thing that I think is just crucial there, besides laying out this whole effort to bring socialism and communism into the school system, was a statement that was made by Rowan Gaither, who was
hold
head of
that,
the Ford Foundation.
Hold that thought. We're going to just bring our stations on. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're talking about the effect of the Great Tax Exempt Foundations here in the United States of encouraging communism and socialism and Marxist training here in the United States. And Dr. Douglas was talking about a man named Rowan Gaither, who was the president of the Ford Foundation. Why don't you pick up the story there, Joe?
The person who was the chief investigator who ran the investigation for the Reese Committee was Norman Dodd. He was an experienced banker, a strong patriot, and he and had a legal background as well. And he took over this investigations job of the tax-exempt foundations for Carol Weiss, who was the representative in charge of it. And one of the things he did is he talked to some of the principals at the various foundations. He got an invitation from one of his letters to go up and talk with Roland Gaither in New York City. And when he went up there, Mr. Gaither on his own asked him if he would like to know what determined the course of the Ford Foundation and their activity. And Dodd couldn't believe his ears, and he said, "Well, I would be most happy to learn that. It would save us a lot of time and effort if you would explain it." And Ron Gaither went on to say then that, well, most of us here at the foundation have had government service in the OSS or Economic Department, and we see as our mission in the allocation of our funds to so change things in the United States as to make it possible to bring about the comfortable merger of the Soviet Union and the United States, and that these directions all come from directives issued out of the White House. Now, when you stop to think about it, you have to ask, well, what does this mean? Because especially back then, and today as well, nobody in their right mind in the United States would want to join with the Soviet Union. It has been a basket case from day one. Doesn't have an ounce of any ethical or morality in the entire government structure. Who would want to be a part of it? Well, the answer is no one. So how do you bring this about? Well, you've got to do two things if you're going to merge the two. You're going to have to tear down the United States, change the belief system of the people in the United States, and at the same time you have to artificially create the illusion that the Soviet Union is something that it isn't. You have to hide their crimes, and you have to publicize benefits that they don't have. Of course, this was the tactic that was taken by many of the established newspapers to hide the crimes and to advertise the Soviet Union as a nation that it had been was nothing like. At the same time, you had all these efforts to undermine the U.S. institutions and make it more vulnerable.
Well, let me just comment that I had the opportunity of interviewing Norman Dodd back in 1980 when he was still with us, and we have a four-tape set called The Secret Government, and you'll hear there my interview with Norman Dodd as he tells the exact story that Dr. Debliss has just relayed. According to Rowan Gaither, the purpose was to so alter life in the United States that one day we could be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. If you'd like to hear that, you can certainly get the Norman Dodd interview. It's part of the Secret Government four-tape set, or you can order it separately, or you can ask, we'll be glad to provide that for you free of charge if you order a copy of Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and specifically ask for it. That's the Norman Dodd interview and Foundations, Their Power and Influence, because that is a summary of the Rees Committee findings, and of course Norman Dodd was the chief investigator for the Rees Committee. Well, let's go to Pastor Richards, who's calling us from Biloxi, Mississippi. Hi, Pastor. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan and Dr. Douglas. How are you doing?
Good evening.
Enjoying the broadcast this evening. The reception is very good.
Okay.
I wanted to ask Dr. Douglas a couple of questions.
Go
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.